House Education Committee for Friday, June 3 is called to order. And looks like I'll have to put some money in our collective pot for the delayed beginning. So we're continuing to collect.
How much do you have so far?
I really haven't counted it. I was going to come down and make a ceremony of it. So we'll have to do that as a collective unit at some point.
Okay. That'd be good.
Yeah.
You want to go get it?
No time. I don't, but thank you very much.
Madam Chair, if it's $100 or less, I will match it as a donation to the school fund.
Whoa, that's absolutely wonderful. We'll leave that offer to anyone out there.
Well, all right, I'll do it too.
Okay, we're up to two. Do I hear three?
Okay.
Four, five. We're just raising bucks all over the place. John, don't be a piker.
Okay, I'll do that.
And by the way,
that's a quite a high
Debbie Parr's in too. She just doesn't know it.
She's from double. What is that? Hey, double, let you double what we usually
there
do.
There we go. Well, that's
this
wonderful.
This is going to go to the Portland Public Schools Foundation?
Well, they'd probably sneeze at that, but we'll find a good, deserving unit, and we've had some preliminary discussion. We'll make that as a collective as well.
But
it will not be
Madam
to our
Chair,
own.
I want you to know that we are working less than minimum wage here.
Well, let it be known for the record, I'm well aware of that.
Mary just came to the door again.
And before you jet off, Representative March, I think I will make this announcement up front, and we'll just make sure that Representative Farr's staff gets the information to her, but since this is our last official meeting, by virtue of this announcement from the podium this morning, we will be preliminary plans, as I understand it, are underway for our group gala, and to stay tuned, information will be forthcoming. And hopefully it'll be before we signy die or see how optimistic I remain. And we'll just keep you posted on those details. So that some people don't get too exercised prior to that point, we do have a couple of matters that we will be reopening at my request and at the Speaker's approval to manage before we blow this place. And Representative Farr, just to bring you forward, you're in for $200 to match the funds that Representative Martin, I'll put in $100. Everybody else put $100. You're $200. So.
And we appreciate it.
And we thank you very much for that. That's our gift fund yet to be determined. Enough
we
of the fun.
Thank you.
So we move rapidly forward then to, we have some information that we needed to resolve and finalize on Senate Bill 52. So we will open a work session on Senate Bill 52. Mr. Keller, if you'll give us some information and we'll proceed.
Allows the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to conduct hearings rather than the Office of Administrative Hearings for license suspensions related to teachers resigning without 60 days written notice. We had our first hearing on it on June 1st. You will also find the vote from the Senate side does not have a subsequent referral, nor does it have any amendments.
Okay, and I see Ms. Chamberlain's here. Would you like to come forward and give us some information, too?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, Executive Director. I'm sorry I couldn't be here Wednesday. I had a doctor's appointment, but I did listen to the hearing this morning on the tape.
I hope it didn't frighten you.
With your permission, I'd like to start over.
Have your way.
Thank you. 52 is a compromise that came out of the original proposal. And the original proposal was to repeal the statute that allowed districts to ask for a licensure suspension if an educator doesn't give 60 days notice. And the reason is because back in 1999, the legislature had us turn our discipline hearing appeals over to the Office of Administrative Hearings, which is now like mini court. It takes months to get these hearings scheduled. And as a matter of practice, whenever anybody appeals, everything that happens on their license gets stayed. So here's what has happened. most of these happen at the beginning of a school year. By the time the school boards pass a resolution to ask to have the license suspended, we often don't get notice till October or November. The teacher then requests an appeal. We ask to file it with the Office of Administrative Hearings. In the last three cases that we've had, we've got resolution from them, an opinion in either April or May, or in the one was June 30th, which was 2 weeks after the school year expired. Well, the statute only allows the license to be suspended for that current school year. So what people learned is that if they appealed, they could keep their license active the entire year. Sometimes we could suspend it up to 2 weeks. That was one piece of it. The second piece of it is we have to pay the cost of the hearings, not the educators or the school districts. So I brought you an example of the last hearing we had. This was just merely to have the hearing on the issue of did they give 60 days notice or not. No, they didn't. The administrative law judge writes an opinion, and it cost us $1,000, $1,052 out of our budget. So the way the process was working, it wasn't working. When the statute was first written, all of those hearings came straight to TSPC, and they usually could make a determination at their first fall meeting. So we brought forward to repeal the statute. The school boards and the administrators didn't want that to happen, and I would tell you that the administrators on the commission do not want that to happen. So the compromise was, instead of sending these to the hearings officer panel, is that TSPC would take just these specific hearings back, which would allow us to have a hearing on the issue immediately, at least at our next meeting, if they appeal. And that's much more expeditious for everybody, and it saves us a lot of money. And the district knows, the educator knows, and so that's 52.
Okay.
But 48 is related, so I don't know how you want to handle that.
Questions?
Back in 99, what was the compelling reason to move the hearing process to an administrative hearing?
Well, all of the little boards and commissions in the state and the agencies all have held their own hearings, and we all had our own hearing officers, although ours were heard in front of a commission. And there were actually a lot of people who thought that it wasn't objective if the hearing officer was being paid directly by the agency or was an employee of the agency. So they created the office and moved all of these administrative rule hearings and discipline hearings, discipline or actions on licenses for sure, to this Office of Administrative Hearings. And in all candor, it is a much more objective forum. Their opinions are advisory back to the boards, though. So it's I think it's an efficient process for most things that we do. But it's
thank you, Madam Chair. After, if we go to teacher standards and practices, and a teacher has a question on procedure or even fairness, what's the next step in the process after you then?
As in all cases, Representative Dallum, Chair Foreman, I apologize for not doing protocol. The appeals to the Court of Appeals. That's administrative law in the state.
Thank you very much.
Further question, Representative Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If it is appealed, you've already taken the license. The appeal, so they've already lost the license after you've taken your action. The Court of Appeals can reinstate it, but the action is taken at the time that you are done. Is that correct?
Representative Chair Flores, Representative Roman, the law is, for us, is that, okay, let me do this. I won't do the hypothetical. I'll do the real. The commission recommends a license be revoked. The educator appeals. That goes today to the Office of Administrative Hearings. They may support our recommendation or they may not. If we decide to still have it revoked and they want to appeal further, they have the right to appeal it to the Court of Appeals, but the statute says that the action on the license is stayed. So until the Court of Appeals rules, no actions can be taken on the license as long as the educator continues to ask to have it appealed. The the thing the statute says about the 60 days is it says the decision of the commission is final. But my AG has told me he doesn't think that'll hold up in any court, and that if anybody asks to appeal our final decision on the suspension of the 60 days, they still have access to the Court of Appeals.
Follow up.
Mostly a statement. I appreciate you coming today and doing 52 before 48. 48 makes sense if 52 happens. It makes no sense without 52. So it just clicked in my head as to why the May is there as opposed to the other. So I just want to say thank you for today's testimony. For me, this makes more sense.
Representative Dunn.
Point of clarification, Madam Chair. If we move the process to teacher standards and practices, you would remove the license. You would have that authority.
Yes.
So the difference is, instead of going through the whole year, it would be now, in September.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Dowland, that's correct, provided they don't appeal to the Court of Appeals, which is actually very expensive. They would have to have a very good case, and it would have to be based on the fact that we violated some procedures, and they could do that. But it's not likely, but that's what would happen. Everyone always has a right to ask the Court of Appeals to review agency decisions.
Further questions?
Madam Chair.
Representative Lim.
Yes, as I look at this failure to give a 60-day notice, yes, some of them are lowish, this 1 month suspension, some of them are rest of the school year. What's the differences?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, it's just how it ended up being reported in the order. If you look at the dates it was reported, let's take Frank Crawford at the top. He was reported in February, and the commission took action in March, and they did it the rest of the school year. I have no idea why when we took action in March on the next one on Dunham, it was reported in November, the next meeting was in March. It was 3 months to the end of the school year. It could have said the end of the school year. It ended up being 3 months. It's just how it got reported in the orders that were written at that time, and our office just lifted them exactly out of the order and put them into this document. But the statute says that it's only suspended to the end of the school year.
Okay, follow up.
So
when they are suspended, do they get paid, or how do they live on? If the income was the teacher's salary, then they don't have any incomes.
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, you're exactly correct. Once the license is suspended, they cannot teach any longer. I think that's generally the intent. When districts ask to have the license suspended, often I think a lot of these cases are the educators have had licenses that are difficult to in positions that are difficult to fill, and they have left the districts in awkward positions, having to fill positions with substitutes possibly, or candidates they didn't feel were as qualified. And I think the district believes they shouldn't be able to go on to another district and continue to work when the students in their district have been put at a disadvantage. And I think that's the thinking behind the law in the first place.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Ms. Mendez. We will...
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 52A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dahlem has moved Senate Bill 52A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, those of the opinion that Senate Bill 52A should be moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 52A is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Carrier, Representative Dahlem, would you like to carry?
I will carry.
I will defer to Representative Lim.
No, I'd like you to arm wrestle over it.
After the speech
very
on the floor,
good.
You know?
Very good. Very good.
Representative Lynn, would you like to chair this one?
It's an honor to chair.
Thank you very much. So ordered.
I bet on Lynn when
nobody in here. Probably. We won't have the precursor drug discussion here today. We will move to a work session on Senate Bill 342A. Mr. Keller?
Senate Bill 342A requires community colleges and state institutions in OUS to operate a statewide articulation and transfer system, requires community colleges and state institutions to continue to provide and improve effective articulation and transfer framework by completing specific tasks, allows community colleges and state institutions in OUS to implement other measures to create an effective articulation and transfer framework for students, requires OUS and community colleges and workforce development to submit a report on the progress to the emergency board before January 1st, 2007, requires OUS and community colleges and workforce development to report annually to the joint boards of education on their progress, sunsets provision of the measure on January 2nd, 2010, declares an emergency, takes effect on passage. It does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We have a -4 amendment, which would require that it would add a report back to the Legislative Interim Committee on Education.
Thank you. And we did have testimony from Andrea Henderson from community colleges as well. The discussion was pretty thorough, and in addition to the information you just received, we are in work session. Representative Allen?
Madam Chair, I move that the -4 amendment to Senate Bill 342A.
Representative Dolan has moved the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 342A. Is there discussion? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 342A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Dolan has moved Senate Bill 342A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation with a subsequent referral to, or do we have to deal with the rescission to Ways and Means and refer to budget first, probably?
It goes to budget.
It automatically?
With,
yeah. Okay.
With a subsequent referral to
budget.
To budget.
I'll start over. Representative Dolan has moved Senate Bill 342A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Budget. Is there discussion? Those of the opinion, Senate Bill 342A should be moved to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and a subsequent referral to the House Committee on Budget will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. Clerk will please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Having received the required majority, the motion is adopted. You don't need a carrier, so we'll close the work session on that. Okay, we will move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 167, please. Open the public hearing. Mr. Keller, if you'll give us some information.
Authorizes the Superintendent of Public Instruction to provide education services on local, county, or regional basis to children who have traumatic brain injuries. Measure first applies to the 2006-2007 school year. It does not have a subsequent referral, and we do not have any amendments.
Okay, thank you very much. It looks like we have Claudia Clark and Nancy Latini. You can both come forward, I think, together.
Chair Flores, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Latini. I'm the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships at the Department of Education. As you know, federal law requires that all students with disabilities receive the services that are determined by the IEP team, Individual Education Plan team, and which includes the parent. Some of these students have what we call low-incidence disabilities, and they're served in Oregon by a regional program system. Disabilities under low incidence means that there are very few of these children across the state of Oregon, but their needs are unique and usually need some specialized types of services provided to them. That's where the regional program steps in, because they have the capacity then to provide these services at no cost to the extra cost to the districts. When you compare the students that are low incidence, you talk about traumatic brain injury as one of them, with right now our total count was close to 300 students spread across Oregon, compared to learning disabilities where we have thousands of students that are considered having learning disabilities and are spread across the state. Senate Bill 167 would allow the department to add traumatic brain injury to the list of disabilities that the regional program staff serves. It would allow us then to use that existing system and that structure to improve the services for these students. Adding this was the adding traumatic brain injury to the list of regional services was the most often cited issue when we did an evaluation last year with the districts. In other words, when we asked the special education directors what additional services would add value to the regional system, they most often identified adding traumatic brain injury as one of the things that would help them to provide the services. Like all disabilities, the disability of traumatic brain injury generates general federal funds. These funds would be directed to the regional program for those districts that want to use their services. So there would be no new funds needed. We would just redirect some of our funds. The amendment that is added would put this into effect in July 1 of 2006. That would allow the department to talk to and work with specialty staff and also with special education directors and parents about what the services would best look like to serve them. I brought with me today, asked Dr. Claudia Clark to come, who's a special services director at Cascade School District, and she was going to just, if you wanted to hear a little bit about how what really happens as far as services in school districts with regional and particular traumatic brain injury. I'll let her talk, and then I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I think it would be very helpful.
Madam Chair and Representative, I am currently Director of Special Services at Cascade School District, which is just a few miles from here and has approximately 2,300 students. My former life, which began prior to fall of 2003, I was coordinator of special education in Medford School District, which has somewhere between 12 and 13,000 students.
Dr. Clark, before you continue, excuse me, I just need to ask you to identify yourself for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. I am Dr. Claudia Clark. Okay. I give you the perspective of both of my positions simply because I wanted to make a point about how low incidence traumatic brain injury is. Currently at Cascade, we have no traumatic brain injured students. In Medford School District, of about 13,000 total enrollment, we had at any one time five or fewer students with traumatic brain injury. In addition to that, these are very high-impact kinds of students. These are students who have had some sort of physical trauma to the brain, and they are very unpredictable in their behaviors, in their ability or disability as regards communication, cognition. They have very little abstract thinking ability. They don't understand cause and effect. All in all, they're extremely challenging students to be able to serve appropriately. They often have sensory and physical kinds of impairments. So many of their needs are served well by the specialty areas that already are involved in the regional service programs. And their evaluation for eligibility is challenging without those kinds of specialists and provision of their services. At Cascade, if we received one of these students through a transfer or coming in through preschool, it would be a major challenge for us as a smaller school district to provide services without regional kinds of specialty areas. And I believe, as Dr. Latini's testimony indicated, we would probably have to go outside and purchase some very expensive psychological services and other specialty services. Thank you.
Representative Dahl.
I understand the Cascade School situation. Medford, with a loading of 5 students, would they use a regional concept also?
Indeed, yes. That's very low incidence.
And that would work better there. Mm-hmm. And regional concept, this follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have much more time to get this right, do I?
Yeah, you'll get it. I'm sure of it.
This regional concept is where we get occupational therapy and physical therapy. This would be added to that list. Thank you very much.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in your testimony, you have a definition of traumatic brain injury. And I guess my question is, we have been surveying, but not on a regional basis, these kids under other health impaired previously, or whatever other category we might have called it. So this is only adding like an autism specialist that would come in for specific kinds of things. The school's still going to work with this person on a day-to-day basis, but there are enough, in your opinion, significant differences with this particular kind of thing, like autism, that expertise would be helpful for the local people. Is that...
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, that's exactly right. The difference with traumatic brain injury is usually it's an assault to the brain after birth sometime. And one of the specialty areas, including working with the medical field, is what part of the brain is impacted and then how does that affect, whether it's academic or social or behavioral. And this is where the specialty area would come in to help the schools direct their services.
We had a young woman who was in a bad car accident, and it created an issue for a period of time. And so some of it got better. And again, we got expert help from different people, including the State Department, during that situation, because it was a rare event in our case as well. So you have people currently who could actually do this?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, we do. We, at this point, have contracted services with some people at Western University, and it's a sort of TBI specialist, and they do some, but they don't do the depth of going to the schools. They do a lot of parent support and training overall, but they don't go into the school and work with the exact child.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, my question is, in looking at this, it appears that... for the regional services, would that go through a local education service district? And is that how the services would be provided?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, our regional contracts, we have 8 of them, and they are all housed at ESDs. Yes.
Follow-up? So because of some of the vast areas that certain ESDs would service, I'm assuming then that these children would have a member of the classified staff, their own... mentor, someone to work with them one-on-one in the classroom, and then this special ed teacher that deals specifically with traumatic brain injuries then would meet them on a weekly or bi-weekly basis?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, that's exactly right. Oftentimes it might be a psychologist or a counselor. It might just be a monthly. It depends on, again, the need of the child. The special education teacher in that district and in that school would have primary responsibility for being the liaison and working that out.
Further question, Representative Lynn.
And my question is concerned the cost. The average student per year cost maybe, let's figure, $8,000. Mm-hmm. And what it will cost to this TBI student in a year compared to the regular students?
Chair Flores, Representative Lynn, it would depend. What happens is these children already are identified as traumatic brain injury. Where the cost savings would be is possibly to the school district having to pay for outside experts to come in and help them, like medical people. We would have those people on staff through the regional program that's currently there.
So we do not know the dollar amount because it's all differentiated.
It would be differentiated by the child's needs, right?
Okay. Follow-up questions?
Follow-up.
After such an investment time from the state for educating these TBI students, when they grow up, could they live independently? And of course, it all depends upon the person, but in general sense.
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, that's what our hope would always be. And actually, with the new special education law, they're actually directing districts to plan very carefully, starting at age 16, for outcomes for all students as they become young adults. And it's never been stated as clearly as it is now in the new law. So for all of the kids in disability areas, we would be expecting to see that with children's individual education plans.
Thank you.
Representative Dolan.
I understand. I'm trying to get it makes sense. Western Washington, a contract with them. Tell me how services would be provided in John Day, Grant County. And mechanically, how would that work?
I'm sorry if I said Western Washington. It's Western University in the Dalles. Is that where it is?
Western Oregon?
Oregon, right.
Monmouth.
Oh, right. Yeah. I'm sorry.
That's where it's at.
If I said the other.
We're in the same place, Nancy.
Yeah, no, we all went to the same place, yeah.
As long as they don't take my kids. What would happen with a student in John Day is that if a district decided through their individual education plan team and with the parent that this child did have traumatic brain injury, and hopefully they would already have the medical information, car accident, sporting incident, whatever happened, they would contact the regional service and say, we need somebody to come out here and help us plan for this child. What I have found with traumatic brain injury where we have a good connection is the child is, like, say, at Emmanuel or someplace getting those services and they're ready to go back to school, they would be connected with that regional service and say, this child is coming back to you. The best of all worlds, they'll be there before the child gets there so they can help to make that plan, place them in the right classroom, give them the proper supports, and also help the parents understand. So there would be that continued liaison.
Follow-up. After the planning process, then... And we're still in John Day. Then, mm-hmm. What kind of contact do we have? Let me explain why I'm having trouble here. Occupational therapy, physical therapy, lots of people available, and services out in the hinterland are readily available. With traumatic brain injury, I would think a very small cadre of professionals. Then, what happens after the planning? The student is back to John Day. What kind of services do mom and dad get? What kind of services does the teacher get? What kind of services does the student get?
Chair Flores, Representative Dahl, those are very good questions. And again, it would depend on the severity of the student and the ability of the staff to carry out plans. When the plan is done, it would be written in that educational plan, which is a commitment to resources. So we would expect the regional service to commit to some kind of services. I've seen parent groups, not for traumatic brain injury as much as for like students with autism where there are more students, but maybe some kind of parent consultation, observation in the classroom and coming up with suggestions about this might not be a good time to be in the classroom, it's too confusing, have the child go to the resource room at this time. Having some of those specifics, having a special education teacher that's in the district observe and monitor and have a direct link to the regional people. If there is a therapy service that has to come, it would be directed on that individual education plan. Once a week, once every 2 weeks, this person will be here to conduct these services.
Follow up. If we had a student in one of the far-flung corners of the state, we'll go back to John Day right now. How is the same service, I'm sure, is provided?
Should be.
And how are they doing it now?
For the traumatic brain injury child?
Yes.
Most often what happens with traumatic brain injury children is if you're fortunate to have staff close by that know how to do these kinds of things and understand it, that's fine, and have connection with the medical field and where the child had been, you might be able to get some services there. The fear is that oftentimes that would have to be paid for by the district. The services oftentimes are not appropriate services because the staff doesn't understand what they should be doing, that the training hasn't been there. They will certainly get some kind of services.
It's probably not always, and that's what we're hearing from special ed directors. Are we sure we're doing the right thing? So if a child has some emotional needs and it's based on traumatic brain injury, it's not that they're a bad child or that they need a behavior plan, but you need to anticipate when that might happen. Classroom is too active. Maybe he should be removed or he's going to blow up in class. So at this time when these things are going on, have him be in the special education resource room. And so that kind of planning for the child to make sure that he's successful.
Thank you. So the question and the issue that the bill addresses is a higher level of proficiency from the practitioner, a more targeted level of proficiency, and a continual contract and availability. That's what we're doing.
That sounds definite.
Representative Roblin.
Kind of a comment, I think, as anything. We have had autism specialists in the regional level for a long time, and so annually they'll come and look at the plan and go over things and bring expertise to the local staff who have been working with the new information that they've observed during that year. In traumatic brain injury, for us, the one example which was interesting to us was the fact that when we finally got someone who knew kind of things to expect, we realized that our counselor was going to be an important part because the student recognized that they used to know things that they don't know. And so they'd be in a classroom and they would get just totally frustrated with themselves because they knew this. And now, and because something came up in a discussion, they knew they had known that before and now they didn't know it. And they got fixated on that and angry. And it was the acknowledgement that the teacher should notice that and say, you need to go talk to your counselor for a while. So then they go talk to the counselor and the counselor would go through the whole thing again about, you know, this is part of the process. You're going to go through this. And they had a little bit of explanation of what was going on. And this is the kind of person that lets people in the school know the kinds of things to expect down the road, because there appears to be a body of knowledge that says there are certain things that are pretty common amongst these kids who've had traumatic brain injury. And because we don't see it very often, we wouldn't even know that. But these people do know, and I'm always shocked because it shows up, just like they kind of said it was going to happen. And if you're prepared and you have it in the plan and the parents are knowing it, it makes a difference. But previously that was very expensive because you have this person that is there and you want to deal with them. They've been in your school district their whole lives and they were in a bad car accident. And so now you have to go figure it out. What this is, it says that the state is going to have some of those people ready and able. So I appreciate the idea. So thank you.
Representative Dahl.
And one final question. In the sum total, this will be more cost-effective than contracting around the entire state.
Chair Flores, Representative Dahl, absolutely it would be more cost-effective.
Thank you.
Ms. Latini, I just have a couple of questions. Perhaps you made reference to it, and I know the doctor did, that it's a low-incidence situation. But do we have record of what statewide the incidence of traumatic brain injury students might be?
The count for December of 2004 was up close to 300, 291 students, I believe it was.
Okay. Thank you. And then you also made comments in regard to redirecting funds in order to accommodate these services. And currently, where are those funds originating? Are they all federal funds, or are they federal match, or help me
sure,
clarify
Florida,
on that?
They're all federal IDEA funds, and they go to the district at this time where the child is. This is not a required choice for a district. They can choose to use the regional service, and if that's the case, the IDEA federal funds would go with the child to the regional program. If not, they will stay with the district.
And the district could determine how then to utilize those funds to benefit the TBI child.
Exactly.
Okay.
On that line.
Representative Dahlem and then Representative Roblin.
When we move IDEA funds, do they fully cover the cost of serving traumatic brain injury students?
Chair Flores, Representative Dahlem, IDEA money doesn't cover any of our children in an adequate fashion. We're at about 20% of the cost of what they had promised by now.
Then if we go to the regional concept, we're still going to have the shortfall. Who's going to make that up?
the funds still remain with the weighted fund from the school support fund and how we fund education in general and the weighted cost for special education students in the state school fund. It's all the same.
Let me clarify the question. Right now, John Day, mm-hmm. we got to go somewhere else. But John Day has a traumatic brain injury. And the district will provide the service. The district would now identify the student or make them an identified student and get the weighted formula, but the cost would exceed that. The district kicks it in. We're going to a regional concept, and the region's going to pay for it, and they're not going to get fully funded. Where is it coming from now that we go to a regional concept?
Chair Flores, Representative Dalton, now I understand your question. We right now have that contract with Western Oregon University that we would direct those funds into the regional support as well. And we figured that that would be able to cover the numbers of students that we have along with the IDEA funds and the staffing in the regional program.
Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Yeah, the other point, I guess, when I look at 291 or so, the number of some of these are the shaken baby syndrome kids. Is that not right? I mean, some of the, and we've heard that in the news, we've heard the other issues. Some of those kids, the traumatic ones that we hear are the deaths of some of those children. But there's another group of those children that are young and who are shaken bad enough to cause traumatic brain injury. And then they become an issue for the schools as they go through. And that's another part of this whole thing that I think we need to recognize. The violence that is perpetuated against some of our children creates long-term cares for the rest of us in society. So, just a comment. And is that not true part of those kids?
Yeah.
Any further questions? Thank you very much, ladies.
Thank you.
We will close then. Oh, was there anyone else that was here to provide testimony on Senate Bill 167? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 167 and open a work session on Senate Bill 167.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 167A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Dolan moves Senate Bill 167A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Those of the opinion, Senate Bill 167A should move to the floor with a due pass recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 167A will move to the floor.
I would like to be the chair.
You would?
I would really like to carry this one.
How about if we have Representative Dahlman and Representative Roblin as co-carriers?
That'd be great. I'd love
it. I would like that. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 167. And I think we're in a position to have a work session on House Bill 3075. We're there, folks. Well, we can have some information and discussion, and by the time we're at that point, I think we'll have the documents ready.
You're very optimistic.
I'm very optimistic. So we'll open a work session on House Bill 3075. Would you please give us some information?
House Bill 3075 directs that a child who is placed by a public agency or a private agency in substitute care program is considered a resident for school purposes in the school district in which the child resided prior to placement. Allows a child to continue to attend the school the child attended prior to placement. Directs the court to give preference in placements to persons who can maintain the child in the same school or educational placement as prior to placement. Changes time period for transfer of education records of the child who is in the substitute care program when the child transferred from one school or educational placement to another. Directs that placement agency is responsible for providing transportation for the child. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005. We've had two earlier meetings on this bill. We had -1 amendments that were not adopted. We received additional amendments, and they've all been folded into the -2, which you have. And we were expecting just any second now a -3 amendment. and we have some folks here that can talk about all the amendments.
Yes, and I would in this work session invite testimony in regard to that which has brought us to the point we find ourselves. So I know there probably wasn't a sheet out there, but I would ask the interested parties to please come forward.
Thank you so much, Chair Flores. My name is Angela Sherbo. I'm a senior attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project. It is our office who brought forth this concept. With me is Brian Baker, also an attorney at the Juvenile Rights Project, and Kevin George from the Department of Human Services. And I think we are here to say to you that after a long and arduous process, and with a lot of good faith and a lot of hard negotiations, I think we are in complete agreement on the bill as it will be amended once those dash threes get upstairs.
I think I just walked in the door, but we won't mention that right now. No, not you. The amendment, that's okay. You're sitting back in the bobblehead, though.
Yes, so that is the bobble.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's all I have. Mr. George may want to address you as well, and then we're absolutely happy to answer any questions the committee has.
Very well.
Chair Flores and members of the committee, my name is Kevin George. For the record, I'm the foster care program manager at the Department of Human Services, and I would concur with Ms. Sherbo's synopsis that this has been a very long 6 months, but we've actually worked on a number of things, and both conceptually and by the written word that we'll be seeing shortly, I assume, we are in agreement with where we're at this point.
Very well. Any comments from our third panelist?
Chair Flores, Brian Baker, attorney with Juvenile Rights Project, and I'm ready to answer any questions that may come up in the discussions.
Okay. We'll stand at ease for a moment until we have these distributed. Ms. Hunt is just going over them with the administrator. She'll stay around, I'm sure, so she can help clarify any questions we might have.
Madam Chair, while we're waiting, do you mind if I make a comment?
You certainly are free to do that.
Okay. Thank you. I in looking at the intent of this and our previous discussions, in trying to do the best by each of these foster children, I was taken by this approach to the extent that I did not push a different bill of mine regarding foster children. And because I think this is a much more, allows much more flexibility, and it gets to the intent that I had of really protecting those foster children. And so I appreciate us working on this.
Oh, good. Thank you very much. That's very affirming that we are able to accomplish a good policy piece. Mr. Keller?
We're in a process of getting copies for the entire committee. Cindy Hunt is still here. The dash three, she was able to fold everything together, so we just have one amendment to pass. But if you could have Cindy come up and talk about the amendment that's on page 2, line 11, I appreciate it.
Okay. And who's going to distribute to us?
Well, we've got to get the copies first.
And we're back at ease.
You want to go at ease until we get the copies?
Well, it'd be easier to do that with
okay.
Having them in front of us. I think.
I would like that.
Representative Roblin?
Could I ask the group just
sure,
a question
do.
While we're doing?
Okay. Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is, and it always has been in this whole process, before anybody's going to make a determination that this is the best, they're going to take in consideration the local school districts, they're going to have people at the table, there's going to be the caseworker and possibly the foster parent along, and then eventually the court person is going to make a decision as to, yes, this is the best deal, and once that's decided, that's the school they can stay at. Is that kind of a gist of the whole thing?
Chair Flores, Representative Roblin, that has been the genesis of the idea from the very beginning, is to create a structure where all of the parties, all of the individuals who may be working with that child and family, have a venue, a place to go to talk about the individual needs of the child, and absolutely would include school folks, would include family members, foster family members, providers that are working with the child. And again, a structure that's completely open to really look at the best interest of the child and examine all of the interests of those parties.
Okay.
question. Representative Dolan.
How many cases are we talking about in a school year? How many times will this group have to adjudicate this type of an issue?
Chair Flores, Representative Dallin, that has been one of the most difficult issues to try to determine the actual number of children. We have data that looks at how frequently children move while they're in foster care during an academic year, and some of the information from the Casey Foundation, for example, the 30% of children have 10 or more school moves, 65% have 7 or more school moves. Anecdotally, from our practice as children's attorneys, very commonly have children making 3 or 4 or 5 school moves. So it is difficult to track down that number. Generally, we know that approximately 30%, and I'm looking at Mr. Joy, 30% of the children in care, the roughly 7,000 children in care, will make a move during an academic school year. But what it doesn't get at is that all of those myriad of elements that will come into the discussion: how far is the move? Is it too far to remain at that prior school? Are there better services or different services or more appropriate services in the new school, so it makes sense to be resident in the new school as opposed to the former school, or vice versa? The services, the individual education plan, so forth, that was provided at the former school that's only 5 miles away. It makes every sense to maintain the child there.
I'm going to restate Representative Roblin's question. Now, let me set the stage. The judge is trying to determine the best interest of the child. He will have, as sources of information, the caseworker, your people, the sending and the receiving school, and from them he will collect information, and then the judge will be able to make what he considers what's in the best interest of the child, a decision in the best interest of the child.
Thank you.
And the school will be represented. Do I understand the process right now?
Chair Flores, Representative Dallin, I have a slightly different answer than the one Mr. Baker gave. It's only slightly different.
Okay.
it's additional to his, and I also wanted to address the previous question about moves as well. We're kind of a tag team here. We've worked together a long time. With respect to the decision about best interest, in each and every case of children who are covered by this statute, there's a juvenile court judge who is reviewing that case, and in virtually all of those cases there are lawyers for the parents and for the child. The district attorney's office is involved, and the child welfare agency is involved. In many, many cases there are also developmental disability case managers, school teachers, and other school personnel who are intimately involved with the child and whose positions may be made known. It is not the case typically that a school district administrator would be present at a juvenile court proceeding. So that's the clarification I want to make plain to people. The interests of the school and the school's opinion about which school might better serve the child can and should and will be considered by the judge. But in my experience, and I've done this for many years, school personnel are only present at juvenile court proceedings when there's a school issue. So in those cases where something like that's disputed, they might well be present.
So if we're looking at best interest of the child and the focus of the issue is stay put in the school they're in, the direct question would be then, I'm not concerned whether it's an administrator, a special ed teacher, or a classroom teacher that has a particular fondness, will the school be represented?
Chair Flores, Representative Dahl, I'm not sure I can answer the question any better than I did before. The interests of the school conveyed through the parties will absolutely be represented. And the other thing I can tell you is, again, in my experience, is when a judge has a difficult decision to make, particularly in a juvenile court, they'll just call additional people and ask. If they're not satisfied that the parties are presenting all of the sides, that judge might well call and ask, but I don't want to represent to this committee that the juvenile code provides for party status, if you will, to a school district, because it does not. Is that helpful?
The answer is very clear, but it would seem to me, if we are talking about the best placement for the child in a school, the best answer would come from a teacher or a representative of the school. There is a relationship between student and teacher, and I have great faith in that profession. And it concerns me that they would that things would be done to a school, not with the school, and that concerns me deeply.
Chair Flores, Representative Dellum, and then I'll let Mr. Baker, who may do a better job than I so far in responding. That information will be conveyed to the court. The court can't make a determination about which school is better without information that ultimately comes from the school. I'm simply saying it may not come directly from the, and it certainly can. There is nothing that would prevent the teacher, the district administrator, the special ed director, or anyone from participating in the proceeding about best interests. And juvenile court proceedings are rather informal. That could be done in the form of a letter. No one needs to leave their school building in the middle of the day to do this. They can submit it in writing. They can submit records, and that stuff is considered. That's the business of the juvenile court. They're used to looking at lots of different areas of child's life and balancing those things and making a determination of best interest. It will also be the person who is asking, because let's remember, this bill is not an automatic. Children will move in foster care and they will not go back to their previous school unless and until there has been that court proceeding and unless and until there has been that gatekeeping function. The person who's asking the court to make that finding is going to have to present evidence to the court that it's in the child's best interest, and that, as you say, the very best evidence of that is from the schools.
Representative Farr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I think that my question is probably pretty easy for you to answer. My first question. What truly is the purpose of this bill? Who is this bill directed towards helping?
Chair Flores, Representative Farr, that allows me to answer the number question as well. I think that children in foster care, many children in foster care in Oregon are very fortunate. They don't move. The statistics DHS has showed us are that 68% of the kids in foster care do not make a placement change during the school year. And we know that kids who are in relative placements move much less frequently. And we know that many children who don't have extreme needs don't move as frequently. But we have children who move, some of whom have special ed needs and some of whom are general ed students, who because of the burden on the foster care system and because of the geography of the state and district lines, will move a few blocks, a mile, and cross an arbitrary district line. They will have had, and I will tell the committee that part of the genesis for this bill was a case of my own. Four students, all elementary school, all in one district, the eldest in fifth grade, ready to graduate with his, if you can call it graduation from fifth grade, but I guess they do now, with the cohort of children he'd been with since kindergarten, ties to that school by the family, a move by child welfare of those four children, splitting them into the two boys in one home, the two girls in another home, into two more districts, not just one different district. One district, two more districts contiguous to the original district. Now, there's nothing in the current law that prevents the districts from entering into agreements to permit these kids to return. But what the issue that we wanted to get at was saying explicitly, then when it's in the best interest of the child, it's the juvenile court and it's the child welfare agency's responsibility to make sure that child gets the highest quality of education and the most continuity of education that we all as adult citizens of Oregon can provide. So it's those kids, and I think there are many kids it will not apply to. There are kids who are going to move too far, and nobody is going to suggest it's in their best interest to travel long distances. I think it will apply to kids toward the end of the school year, much more so than it will apply at the beginning of the school year. If you have a child who's getting ready to graduate or has all of their work done and is accumulating credits, it may make sense to transport that child a little farther, or an older child a little farther, than at the beginning of the school year when a child is going to be, it doesn't have much of an attachment to the first school. So one of the things that we who do this juvenile court and child welfare work have as almost a mantra is this individualization. And I know you all as educators have the same mantra. Each of these kids is different. Their needs is different. Needs are different. And what we want to do with this bill is remove as many barriers as possible to making an individualized decision.
Madam Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. Well, I'm not sure how to frame the question, so let me just make a statement first and compliment those of you that have been working on this bill, because you just hung on. And every time I came up with an objection or a question, you had an answer for me. And I was very clear in stating up front I didn't want it to be a burden on the schools. I didn't want it to be a burden on the foster families. And I mean, at the heart of all this, when I ask you who the bill is designed to help, who it's designed to help are foster kids who are in a situation that is difficult at best, and it's designed to help them be successful students and ultimately successful contributors in society. And any way that we can do that to lessen the burden that they feel, I think, is our obligation. But for my last question, which isn't really a follow-up, but one of the concerns that we had was on the foster families and if this would be a burden on them in terms of time, resources, and energy. And could you answer that question?
I'll let him talk for a
minute. All right.
Chair Flores, Representative Farr. The hope is with the bill actually that this is going to support foster families, again, in this individualized determination, that you look at those circumstances where it's been beneficial for the child to be in that prior school. Just as you were saying, the connection, the continuity to peers, to there may be a mentoring teacher, a mentoring aide who is a positive role model to that child while they're in care. So all of the other issues in their lives that are impacting their day-to-day existence and the loss of so many things, of friends, family, the separation. Here is an opportunity to maintain some connection, some positive connection, both to kids of similar age and to positive adults. But again, the court, the awareness, the juvenile court being aware of the circumstances of that placement, of the needs of that foster family. Foster families are made aware of any hearing, of any juvenile court hearing. They are welcomed at hearings to give information to the court about the needs of the child. We, again, very carefully drafted this to not specifically put any burden on foster parents around the issues of that school placement. And so if the discussion became that it appears this is the only way to get a child to that school via transportation by the foster parent, there will be an opportunity for that foster parent to say, yay or nay, I've got a job, I can't do it, I can't be there at 3:30 to pick up the child, it's too far. And those are all absolutely legitimate concerns and considerations for the court to say, in this circumstances, weighing school placement versus this wonderful new foster placement for you, I think you should attend the new school. Or they may say, just on the opposite side, that hearing from the foster parent, it's appropriate, it's not going to be an undue burden. I like the example of the child who has 3 months left of school, and maybe it is Redmond to Bend, and that might be too far normally, but for 3 months left to finish out with those friends, foster parent's willing to do it, and the determination is to go ahead and keep the child at the former school.
Further questions?
Just to follow up on that last example, and the Bend School District saying, yes, we're willing to do this too, and we think it's the best for the child. Thanks.
Chair Flores and Representative March, I really, as Ms. Sherbo was testifying earlier, it's my experience that the attorneys, that the caseworker, there may be a court-appointed special advocate, all of those folks are directly contacting school staff, whether it's administrators, special ed teachers, to talk about and to find out information about the child's experiences within the school, to really bring that information to the court to weigh then whether maintenance at the prior school makes sense or to look to the change.
Thank you.
Representative Lynn.
Thank you. Concerning that transportation, to me, is a big concern that the public agency shall be responsible for providing the child with transportation. This is a commanding there. There's no other choice. And this parent has some choice if they want to. Because according to this language here, public agency shall be responsible. Where is the parents, the foster parents are coming in if they want to provide the transportation?
Chair Flores and Representative Lim, the agency as legal guardian over the child when the child is awarded the state, the agency has responsibility around placement of that child, placement in foster care. And what we're saying with this bill is along with that decision, with that move, with that placement, that if in those circumstances where one of the parties brings this to the juvenile court's attention and there's a decision about having residency remain at the prior school, that equally, as legal guardian, that responsibility be with the agency that made the placement change, that moved the child from that school. And then at that point, as part of that best interest determination, the court to hear those types of specific questions, what form of transportation. I'm trying to recall my testimony at the last hearing in early May. I believe I cited any number of different mechanisms for how children might be transported, from use of a public bus if the child's older and capable of using a bus pass. It might be designating special private transportation and paying for that transportation. It might be asking the foster parent if they're willing and able to provide that and reimbursing the foster parent. It could be identifying family members, extended relatives who might be willing, Uncle John who's available to come in and pick up at the foster home and maybe isn't a relative resource, but for this piece can get the child to and from school.
I think I understand, but the problem is the language is clear, that the public agency that has pledged that child shall be responsible. It seems to me there is a negotiation in the language here in case a foster parent wants to take care of that transportation.
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, let me give it a shot. The language is mandatory in that respect to make very clear that it is not the school district's obligation. But the language that says it's DHS's obligation, or the public agency's obligation, here we're talking about DHS, as the parent, we in no way would prevent a foster parent from doing the transportation. It does not mean a state employee when it says the obligation is of the public agency, not at all. I think when Mr. Baker talked about the Bend Redmond example, which seems long distance to me, but I'm at least at present a city girl. I've lived in the country before, and so I know it's a lot less distance when you're in the country. That's an example. That's a real life example of someone who's doing it now, a foster parent who's doing it without any of this bill, without, I don't know whether they're being reimbursed or not, but doing it because it was the right thing to do. I have done it as a foster parent. Other people do it. What we want to do is make it possible for those who can't do it on a voluntary basis, either because they're not available, because they work, but they can't afford the increasing costs of gas, to make it available for them to do it as well. But there's a lot of it going on now.
So follow up, Madam Chair.
Follow up, but if you're on this particular point, Representative Lynn, but I do want to have Cindy Hunt go over the -3 amendments in detail, so that may answer some of your questions.
Okay, and I want to make sure that in case of parents, foster parents doing the transportation, are they being compensated? How do they compensate?
Yes.
Chair Flores, Representative Lim, this bill would permit compensation of the foster parents. DHS already has Oregon Administrative Rule, which provides for, excuse me, we don't have water, do we? Provides for the reimbursement at X cents a mile for foster parents. In fact, the reimbursement for foster parents is at the same rate that caseworkers are reimbursed. That exists currently for transportation to school.
Thank you. I'm fine.
You're fine? Okay. Do not run away. Maybe replace yourselves, and we'll have Ms. Hunt come forward, and then if any of the others who have been involved in these long, protracted negotiations would like to make comments, I'd be happy to have you come forward as well. Okay. Thank you.
Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel's Office. I understand now you have the Dash 3 amendments in front of you. And the biggest change, or the only change, rather, in the Dash 3 amendments is found on page 2, and it affects this responsibility of the public agency to provide transportation to and from school of these children. So the addition that was put in on page 2 is at lines 11 through 14, and what this, it's my understanding what this addition was meant to get at is it's saying that essentially that the Department of Human Services only has the responsibility of providing transportation to these children if the department has had funds specifically designated for that purpose. And what I've been told is that in the Department of Human Services budget this time, there will be in a budget note funds designated specifically for this purpose. So under the amendments, though, if that doesn't happen, then the Department of Human Services does not necessarily have to provide transportation.
And I will make a paragraph note here that Ms. Hunt is referring specifically to the Dash 3 amendments. We also have the Dash 2 amendments that we will need to be adopting. Did you fold 2 into 3?
Chair Flores.
You're quicker and better than we thought.
That's I'm fast. Yes, everything that's in the Dash 2 amendments is in the Dash 3 amendments.
Perfect.
So if it's the committee's pleasure and they like the paragraph C, the language about the funding, then you would adopt the Dash 3. If you don't like that language, you would adopt the Dash 2 amendments.
And the Dash 2 amendments, I guess, needs to be clarified. We had not really gone over either.
Oh, okay.
So you were not privy to the earlier portion, so you wouldn't know that. But we had not discussed the Dash 2 amendments, which had some limiting language in there.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want to just address those for us as well? That would be then beginning on page 1.
Yeah. Okay. So on page 1, what the Dash 2 or the Dash 3 amendments is doing is it's talking about when a juvenile court determines that it's in the child's best interest to continue the child to attend school in the school that they were attending prior to the placement by a public agency, in this case, Department of Human Services, then the child is still considered resident for school purposes in the school district in which the child resided prior to the placement. And so on a side note, what that means is they, for purposes of state school fund distribution, they're still considered a resident child. And then also they may continue to attend school in that school district that they were prior to the placement through the highest grade level of that school. So then the next part of the amendment, which is what we were talking about with the transportation, directs the public agency that they're responsible for providing transportation to the child to and from school. And then the difference between the Dash 2s and the Dash 3s is that the Department of Human Services is only responsible for providing the transportation if they've been given funds by the Legislative Assembly that are specifically designated for that purpose within their budget. Then the rest of the amendment, let's see, in Section 3, over on page 4, it directs a school or an institution or an agency to notify the school where the student is formally enrolled about the student and to request the student's education records. And I think in the original bill, this was within 3 days, and this has been extended to 5 days in the amendment. And that's been done in both subsection 3A and B.
And then, Ms. Hunt, also, I think we should just for the record note that the dash 2s now folded into the dash 3s, eliminated or narrowed to public agency rather than public and private agency.
Chair Flores, that's correct. That's correct. In the original, I think, bill, there was a reference to private agencies as well in Section 1, and that's been taken out totally.
Now, are there questions on the dash 3?
I have one technical question.
Please, Representative Lim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is 5 days, not later than 5 days. Does it include the weekend or strictly working 5 days?
Representative Lim, Chair Flores, I believe it would include the weekend as well, because it doesn't say working days. It just says 5 days.
Okay. Then a follow-up.
Follow-up?
Comments. Sometimes a long weekend is 3 days. Mm-hmm. Only 2 days left over. I might have some problem there. Maybe this might work out all right.
I think Representative Lim, if I recall correctly from earlier testimony and discussions in this committee, it was we did narrow the timing significantly, primarily because there seemed to be some long protracted delivery time, and we did try to narrow that and put a little bit of a compression on the delivery and receipt of those records. Representative Gollum?
On the time issue, when a non-foster student moves from one school to another, is there a time limit on their records? Do you know?
Representative Gollum, Chair Flores, I believe there is. If I could look at the statute, I could tell you specifically. It's my recollection. I think it's 10 days, but is someone nodding behind me? Oh, I got it right. Okay. So 10 days. Yeah.
Are you formulating? Can we go to Representative Roblin?
Go ahead.
Thank you.
I was going to make a comment. It doesn't always happen in 10 days.
No.
That was, I think, the concern. Yeah.
But
we were trying to
press. The essential nature of needing that is really important for this receiving school. So I recognize the need here, and I think Representative Dolan would say the same thing. It is very frustrating at times when you get students without records.
Could Representative Roblin and I amend the present law? what happens if the records don't come in 5 days?
There's not much teeth to it.
Let's see here. 90 days in jail.
Let's see. Representative Dallum, Chair Flores, if the records didn't come in 5 days, then certainly the guardian of the student would have grounds to go into the school district and request, you know, that they follow this. And then, I mean, potentially that could be carried out into, you know, the courts and so forth. I don't think it would get that far, you know, to get the courts involved to do a court order to follow the law, actually. But because I would think that most schools, agencies, et cetera, when they get the request, as pointed out, this is the law, would comply.
Further questions? Thank you, Ms. Hunt. And I did invite any additional comment then on the amendments, certainly. They're dropping like flies here.
Thanks for the opportunity, Chair Flores, members of the committee. I'm Doug Barber here on behalf of the Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs. If you remember, at one of your earlier public hearings, our Executive Director, Janet Ahrens, testified in opposition to this bill, as did some of the members from the Foster Family Care Network. It is our understanding, based on the new language on page 2, because this now only applies to public agencies, that our members would be excluded from these provisions.
That's our
understanding. So we're out of it.
Too. Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you. Okay. Any further questions? Everybody's okay. Then we will Representative March address the Dash 3 amendments.
Yes. Madam Chair, I would move the Dash 3 amendments into House Bill 3075.
Thank you. Representative March has moved the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3075. Is there discussion? Thank you. Objection? So moved.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3075 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative March has moved House Bill 3075 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there discussion?
Madam Chair.
Representative Lim.
Okay, I support 3075 as amended, but concerns the cost, exactly how much it's going to be, we do not know. And also another concern I have, since public agencies provide all the transportation, I don't believe this is going to happen, but there might be a chance some parents send to another school district, then they are off any responsibility for transportation because the public agency has to provide the public transportation. I hope this couldn't be utilized that way, but I have some concerns I'm just expressing.
Representative March.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, since this would only be under a court order, I don't think that's going to happen. But if you want to discuss the cost, we're actually going to be hearing the department's budget next week in the special budget committee, and I'll bring that up.
Thank you.
Representative Dolan.
I had several concerns with this legislation. They've all been addressed. It seems to me that if the department has or doesn't have money, that when the judicial review is taken, that the judge would take that into consideration. I'm sure that he would not say to a family, you must haul a child from Bend to Burns and then not provide any money. That's not in the best interest of the parents. So I think we're going to be all right here, and I'm going to support this piece of legislation.
Thank you. Further comment or? Comment or dot, dot, dot. Okay. Thank you very much. Those of the opinion that Senate House Bill 3075 should move to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will please call roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Having received the required majority, House Bill 3075 is adopted. Move to the floor. Representative March, would you like to carry?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, may I ask to be co-carrier of this bill?
But of course! Thank you.
Especially after today. She deserves it.
We sent her out of here with a little supplement.
I need some enhanced.
I think we need to talk to a Senate member.
And I went out of here with a little lunch bill.
I'm a little worried now about this bill.
You got help.
You better make sure Representative Lynn's happy. He started it all. Okay. Thank you. Representative Shield.
I'd just like to thank you for pushing this forward, too, as well as the players. But I know that particularly as we got to the last couple of days, it wouldn't have happened without you. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes. I appreciate that. And thank you for all the parties working to make it happen. Appreciate it. We will close the work session on House Bill 3075. We will move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 83.
That's supposed to be in the audience.
Okay, Mr. Keller, will you please give us some information?
Senate Bill 383 allows students to refuse to participate in and parents and legal guardians to refuse to allow student participation in protection of animal as part of a public school course. Directs school districts to provide alternative materials or methods to demonstrate coursework competency. Declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2005. We have a Dash 1 amendment. And no referral.
Okay. Senator Deckert, would you like to come talk to us about Senate Bill 383?
Yes.
And team.
Why is everyone laughing?
Everyone's happy it's Friday afternoon.
Madam Chair, thank you. It's good to be with your House Education Committee. I think this is my first time before your committee, and so real honored to be before you.
We're honored to have you here.
I am Ryan Deckert, Senate District 14, and this bill, Senate Bill 383, is pretty straightforward. I had a group of students come to me in the interim, and they said, here's our problem. We didn't want to have go through this dissection process. We'd like to have an alternative available to us, and we'd like to have that choice available to us. And my first reaction was, well, let's look and make sure that they have that choice, and we found out that they didn't. And so we think, in the case of conscience, religious beliefs, or others, that parents and students should have that option to do other coursework rather than have to do a dissection of a frog or another animal. And so it's a pretty simple, straightforward bill that just provides a little choice to parents and students to utilize their own conscience in some of these decisions. Nothing more than that, Madam Chair. And I have two folks with me who would like to share their personal experiences.
Very well. For the record, please give us your name.
Madam Chair and committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Laura Ireland Moore, and just want to go through a few points about the bill. It would protect K through 12 students who are uncomfortable with dissection by requiring teachers to notify students that they have a choice and to just provide them some alternatives. And they're only notifying the students and parents who have this as their part of their coursework. And in passing the bill, Oregon would join a growing number of states who have allowed students this choice in dissection. And there's some states listed on the back of the testimony that's been provided. And it really won't deprive anyone of the right to dissect if they want to. It just, you know, provides a choice. And just wanted to share my personal experience as a high school student in biology with the dissection of a cat in my AP biology class. And at that time, I had already formed some personal beliefs about using animals, and I was vegetarian. And fortunately, I had a teacher who was supportive, but there wasn't anything in place about how, you know, what they were supposed to do with me. And so I had to come up with my own alternative, and the students in the class voted on how my grade, how I should be graded in the course. And I just think, you know, it ended up being fine for me, but because people knew about, you know, me and my ethics. But I think it'd be great for students to have something in place where they don't have to go to the teachers and have students voting on how their grade should be decided, and have something in place in the districts that had, you know, so students don't have to come up with their own alternatives. And so I just think this legislation makes sense, and I really just appreciate your support.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Flores and fellow representatives, for the opportunity to testify today. My name's Paula Ray Wilson, and I live in Portland with my husband and 16-year-old son. And my son, Sanford, is a sophomore at Lincoln High School. My husband and I both have MD degrees from traditional medical schools, and my son considers himself a serious science student. And I'd like to make his point first, which is that he tells me there are three groups of students in his biology classes. One are the students who are very interested in the subject matter and would like to participate in the dissections. And then there's another group who have ethical or moral difficulties with dissection and don't choose to participate on those grounds. And he says there's a much larger group which has little interest, unfortunately, at all in the experience. And it's that group that disturbs him because he considers it quite wasteful and disrespectful to the animals involved, and would like for those people to certainly have an option to choose not to dissect, or that everyone should have that option. And he asked me to tell you that this would save financial resources for the school as well. A point for me is, as a mother, I try to teach my son that education is much more than being a passive recipient of information. And I very much want him to question assumptions and know how to evaluate information and make the best decisions that he can. So I think offering a choice to students in this situation is a good lesson to them, to know that there are differences of opinion about how best to learn about anatomy, that anatomy is important to know, and then that they be involved in discussions with parents, teacher, other students, and then make a decision. And hopefully that will more actively engage them in the process of education, because I think it goes much better when people know there's a body of information out there they need to know, and it's their responsibility to actually know it. And there are different people have different ways of learning that information, but I think it shifts the responsibility a bit more onto the student. And the third point is, I know there are some wonderful science resources out there now. I mean, just textbooks with wonderful transparencies. And certainly I think my son in elementary school knew more anatomy than I did when I graduated from high school. I mean, the resources are wonderful now, and I know there are alternatives to dissection. And in fact, my son attended an alternative elementary school, traditional middle school and high school, but his science teacher actually used roadkill for anatomy and dissections, and all of the parents brought roadkill in. There was a freezer. So there are creative alternatives that don't involve financial outlays at all. And in fact, my son is a nature guide at a summer camp, and dissects roadkill for younger children to learn about anatomy. So there are good resources out there, and I think it's good to give people a choice. Thank you. Wear gloves, though.
Well, first of all, I just have to say that I am appalled that an AP teacher would allow your fellow students to vote and determine what grade they think you should receive. So I have to be on the record for saying that, just in case he or she is listening. And secondly, my daughter feels very much the same way you do. And when she's very interested in animals. In fact, she's going to OSU to major in zoology. But in high school biology, she was confronted with some of the same concerns. She went to her teacher in advance and said, I'd love to take this class, but I'm really concerned about dissection. And he said, oh, that's not a problem. There are all kinds of alternatives. You know, there are models. There's computer alternatives. So we'll make it work for you. I really want you to take the class. So I can give that example and tell you that it seemed to work fine for her.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mine is more of a comment as well. Biology was my major, and math. I couldn't make a decision. I finally ended up in math, but my love has always been biology. And so when this first came up, I was shocked that teachers didn't automatically make decisions to give people options and have them already decided, because it didn't make any sense to me as a biology person learning it. And I always say, one of the examples, partners in college, I was in a botany class, and we could not get anything to grow. I mean, we never had anything to look at. And so if it hadn't been for other people who were growing things well that allowed us to share with them the knowledge that they were gaining, we wouldn't have done as well. In fact, we did better than the people who were growing their own, because we had all the other people that we were looking at, and the professor encouraged us because we had nothing to look at, so we could go look at the other people's. And you can do the same thing with dissection. There's a whole lot of options. People who do like it and do a good job can be encouraged to show and share what they've done with another person, and oftentimes they'll get a better education anyway. So I am surprised that we need to do it, but I do recognize that sometimes there are people who say, this is the way we're going to do it, and everybody's going to do it. And I would encourage more people to recognize that there are multiple ways to get the same information across. And I appreciate you bringing it forward, and I appreciate your stories, because there are all sorts of reasons that people have. And I've also been in classes where you take blood and the people pass out. And they knew they were going to do that ahead of time. Why didn't somebody ask and say, is anybody going to pass out first? And if you are, would you please step out? You don't need to go through that experience for everybody here, including the teacher. So, I mean, there are reasons that It just makes sense. So I, again, appreciate you bringing this forward.
Thank you. And I address the committee once again is that, you know, luckily I had strong parents, and you're a great mom to allow and to, you know, raise your child to have a voice, to be able to express that. But as Representative Roblin pointed out, a lot of people and a lot of students don't want to challenge teachers. We're, you know, we're taught not to. My mom taught in the district, and so it was, you know, hard for me to say, I don't want to do this, you know, and but, you know, she encouraged me to do that, and this would be a great, having this bill in place would give students a voice that, you know, don't feel like they have one on their own at a young age. So, thank you.
Further questions? Representative Lim.
I have always one question.
That's excellent. You have one. They have cereal.
That's bad. As I read the bill, the parents can opt out for their children, and also the child or can opt out. In case that the parent's strong morality or religious reasons doesn't want their children to participate in this, but the children himself or herself wants to participate in it, then which one we should go? It doesn't work.
I don't know if it's
Senator,
in the bill.
I think that was directed at you.
I know. Parents.
We don't know. I'm not sure, Representative Lim, who, if, say, the student wanted to, I would think, but I don't know, Representative Allen or Representative Roblin would have better insight into this. I would think the student would have that opportunity, but I would look to our former superintendents there and principals.
In my house, if my son wanted to, he could go ahead. He would be able to choose. But that's just our house.
But the parents doesn't want it, the student wants to participate in it, then I don't think it's going to happen, but in case teacher is at loss, or the teacher doesn't know what to do.
Representative Roblin.
I'll make a stab from an administrative perspective.
Ooh.
As a high school principal, yeah, I know. As a high school principal, the only way I would know that is that the parent makes an objection. And because the child wouldn't. I mean, the issue is they would read this in class, and the student would know that they had the option, but the parent may not know it. And knowing some of our children, they would try to make sure their parent didn't know it, because that's what they wanted to do. But in the case where a parent knew and a child knew, I would ask them to come in and talk it over. And in most of those cases, I would talk to the child and I'd talk to the parents, and I would defer to let the parents and them work it out, and generally they will. I mean, I have never found a case where it wasn't worked out to the satisfaction of one or the other. So, but I think you get the people together and you talk about it. That's what this is all about, actually, is giving voice to people to make their presence known. And it usually works for me.
Representative Dahlman.
On occasion, child does not, and not a dissection, but advanced math comes to mind. The child says, I ain't doing it. And mom and dad said, you are. You're going to be a doctor, a lawyer, or something. And if the child is made to, success is pretty much guaranteed not to happen. And that's been my only experience with that. So I would suppose.
No, you're only allowed one, John.
Just one.
Mr. Keller, you had a comment about that question.
Reading in line 21, it states the school district shall notify students and parents and legal guardians of students about the provisions of this section.
Yeah.
So it strikes me that it's, the parent will trump the student, that they will know about this anyway.
Okay.
I think that's the whole purpose of the bill, is to give them all information that these classes are being offered, but then maybe that's encompassed in the dash one. Representative Lim, your additional
section
question?
Section one here, kindergarten through grade 12 public school student may refuse to dissect any vertebrate or invertebrate animal, or the parents or legal guardian of it. They have the same equal right to be there. According to this section one.
Any comments, Representative Roblin?
I'll go back to my math training. Since it says one or the other, either one can cause it not to happen. If it said and, they'd both have to agree.
Okay.
And another one small question. Concerning that, I always concern the cost. Already teachers have a lot of work to do. This is requiring to send out the letters to the parents. And do you think it's necessary? It's already talking to the children and asking teachers to notify all the students. This will be the cost and time, even though it's a good thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Representative Lim, I think that's an excellent question. When we talk to the school districts about it, and that's encompassed in the Dash 1 amendment, is to really narrow it down to those biology classes that this would really affect. And so I think the administrators and the school boards asked for that as a good policy, an important policy, but to really narrow it down to a small grouping of folks that would get the information to really narrow that universe.
All right. And
Representative Roblin.
Along that line, most science classes have other requirements that the districts are going to send home as well with respect to safety and other things. So it could be included in the same letter that you're already sending. So I don't see it as an expense that much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I see no further questions. Thank you. Was there anyone else who wished to give testimony? School boards, OSBA, COSA? Any comments? Prefer to offer, proffer, otherwise give?
Got our scalpels ready.
We do. We're going to slice and dice this, baby.
Madam Chair, might I say that in true Education Committee fashion, we have dissected this bill completely.
Top to bottom, inside out. Okay.
I would like to opt out.
Speaking of intros.
Mr. Marshall.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association, and Senator Duckett was right. We had a concern about language in the original bill that suggested that school districts notify students, and we wanted to narrow that down so it was the students that were affected. And there are a variety of other circumstances in school districts in various areas of curriculum where parents are able to opt their students out. And we also found out, and so this is not an unusual circumstance, we also found out that given the state of technology, that there are a variety of CD options available that can be DVD options that can be downloaded from the internet that are free, that offer students the same kind of curriculum opportunities relative to anatomy, et cetera, as the actual dissection. So it's probably a good idea to give students options if for whatever reason they decide that this is not something that they or their parents want them to do.
Any questions for Mr. Marshall? Representative Dong?
John.
He's not going to answer me. I might have a question. He don't have an answer.
That's the bobblehead row. I know.
Notice would be a line in the syllabus that says course requires dissection. We're not talking about a letter. We're just talking about notice, and then it's incumbent upon the child and the parent to take action. And that would be appropriate in this bill?
I believe so, yes. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're very welcome, Representative Dahlem. Okay, well, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 383. We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 383, and we have Dash 1 amendments here to consider, which does include the language of district shall notify students who have dissection as part of their coursework. So that's the clarification in that particular paragraph.
Madam Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 383.
Representative Roblin Dahlem has moved Senate. It's getting late. Senate Bill 383. All right. The Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 383. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, so move.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 383 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Dahlem has moved Senate Bill 383 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, those of the opinion that Senate Bill 383 should be moved to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. The clerk will please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. I say that hesitatingly because this is a really one that stretched my comfort zone. Probably should have said this under discussion and comments, but it stretched my comfort zone, but I could see the need, and doggone it, I really hate that. Nonetheless. So, Senate Bill 383 having received acquired majority, we'll move to the floor. Representative Roblin, you're one.
I would love to. I did vermiculture earlier. It was the first thing that I ever dissected was a worm.
The worm bill.
So,
okay.
Knowing that I dissected worms early in my career and giving out people options is a good thing. I would be pleased.
Representative Roblin will carry the bill. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 383. And we will move to a public hearing on Senate Bill 747. Mr. Keller.
Senate Bill 747A requires the State Board of Higher Education to review the long-term viability of state institutions of higher education, prescribes what aspects are to be reviewed by the board, requires the board to issue a report of findings no later than February 1, 2007 to the governor, legislative assembly, and each state institution of higher education, prescribes information to be included in the report, declares an emergency, takes effect July 1, 2005. We have a -3 amendment, and it also has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Thank you. Senator Deckert? And Lisa Zavala.
Am I up, Madam Chair? I was talking to two of your members, so I'm up.
Yes, sir. That would be true.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for passing Senate Bill 383. This is a bill, and I realize we're late in the day, so I'm going to be very brief, but it's one I actually feel really strongly about, and the Chair and I have discussed this issue. No one disagrees on the importance of higher education and the centrality of higher education to the future of our economy. And so we brought this bill forward, and the Chancellor is represented by Lisa today, Zavala. We brought this bill forward to really spur discussion, because as you look at, and we shouldn't compare ourselves to Washington on everything, but they've taken, or maybe anything, but they've taken a very different course, A, in terms of investment in higher education, and I think that should be noted, but B, in terms of how they're going to invest in higher education in their state. They invest more in student aid, they do. But also, they're a state with one-third more population than we have, but they have one less university than we have. And this bill is designed to ask the state board, and we have a new state board and a very talented state board, to really ask the tough questions that I think the legislature, partly in the last 20 or 30 years, and I think our institutions, somewhat in the last 20 or 30 years, have not asked the tough question that if we want to invest in excellence, how do we get there? And I know, Madam Chair, that you've worked on some ideas that I think are pretty intriguing on OHSU and PSU and different ideas of how do you achieve excellence in this state. But I would only note that the University of Washington, they receive more research funding, that one institution, than all of our universities. And that's new money into the state, whether it's private, federal, or NIH, into the state, than all our institutions combined. Because Washington made a decision. I mean, they made a conscious decision that they're going to invest in, and partly it's a historical decision where we have our two or three major research universities spread throughout the valley, but they said they're going to invest in just excellence. And it has reaped incredible benefits for the Puget Sound economy that we simply just could not measure. And so this asks the question, I think at the right time, State Board, come back to us with what are your thoughts, and they're thinking about doing this, but I think it gives them the legislative stamp of approval to come back to us with your thoughts and plan on how we start that important, if not incredibly critical discussion for the state of Oregon on moving our higher education system forward. And unfortunately, Madam Chair, this bill has a referral to budget, so it's not going straight to the floor as I would really hope. But I do think it's an important discussion, and I do think it's important that the legislature involve itself and ask the board, go do this, and don't be shy about it, because I really think it's a critical
discussion, and I can't wait till February of 2007 if we pass it, to see what really bold ideas they have about reshaping our university system. It might ask and require more investment, or at least ask for more investment from the state, but I think it'll be coupled with a plan of here are the hard choices we had to make to really give you the efficiency and the accountability that legislatures would ask for. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lisa Zavala with the Oregon University System. Acting Chancellor George Prinzsteiner would have loved to have been here today, but he is attending a joint boards of education meeting across town. As Senator Deckard has indicated, the Senate Bill 747 would give the State Board of Higher Education the endorsement and the support of the state legislature to undertake the study that is contained within the bill. The State Board of Higher Education has and does have the intent of undertaking a very similar study, and therefore that's why we have presented the -3 amendments that you will be looking at. The -3 amendments comport a little bit closer to the intent of the State Board of Higher Education for long-range planning over the next biennium. And so we are pretty excited about that, and we would welcome the legislature's endorsement of that work. As Senator Deckard indicated, the bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, and that is because the fiscal analysis performed by the Legislative Fiscal Office was a bit vague. It was a bit challenging, as the state, the Oregon University System budget has not been approved and has not been adopted by the legislature at this point. And in addition to that, both the House and Senate co-chair's budget does contain a $700,000 reduction to the Chancellor's Office budget, which will present a challenge to the Chancellor's Office and to the Board to conduct this work. So it is necessary for the budget committees to look at that in relationship to the requirements of this bill, because without that restoration of that cut, it would maybe make it almost impossible to conduct this work without the sufficient staff support to do it. So we do have a concern, and we'd love to work with Senator Deckard and the budget committees to address those concerns. Thank you. Questions for either the Senator or Ms. Zavala? Representative?
I was going to make a little bit of a comment, being a Husky undergraduate and then also being a Duck, and the recognition that they always keep mentioning it to the University of Washington. I was impressed that you chose a Boeing number with 747 for your bill, because the aeronautical engineering department at the University of Washington was a big part of Boeing and that whole stuff. So, I mean, there was a connection. So it just seemed apropos to mention that.
We worked hard on that.
Further questions? Just have a couple.
Sure.
Thank you, Senator. And you know that I completely concur with the need to increase and expand vision and move on to excellence and however we can get there. But would you clarify for me exactly in the course of business, and Ms. Vallow, you as well, what is it that is embodied in here as far as what you would be examining and reviewing and analyzing, for instance, the mission statement, the budget, income and expenditures, faculty staff, rate of faculty staff turnover, so on, that you cannot currently do in your business plan or as a matter of overview of the university system?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that is the essential, I mean, that is really the essential question of what they could do this. And I concur that the State Board of Higher Ed can do this. What I would argue to him, maybe I'll just be very blunt.
You're going to tell us exactly why you want this bill, then.
Well, I'm going to say bluntly why I think it's important that the legislature involve itself.
Okay.
Is I think the political pressures, I don't think we could realize the odyssey that they'll be under in the 2 years when you really say, here is our revenue sources that we've had. And we all know what the pictures look like for our university system over the last 12 years. I'll pick U of O. It was near 40% of the revenue was derived from the state in 1990. It's down to 12%. So we know where the University of Oregon, that's replicated on every campus in the state of Oregon, that the state has no longer become, or is no longer the driver in terms of the financial world of that state. So they know the picture that the state is getting out of the university business in many ways. But
to ask the really difficult questions of if you're an expanding enrollment university or a declining enrollment university. I know from personal experience, I introduced a bill, I think it was my first session or second session, that said we should close Western Oregon University in Monmouth. Now, we didn't get that through the legislature, but the whole sentiment behind that was, and I learned a great deal about how much that how tough it is, frankly. I mean, my argument was we had two universities within a 45-mile radius of that offering many of the same services in a tough fiscal environment. You have to make really, really difficult choices about your institutions if you want excellence. But that actually was because of the pressures within the university system who work with each other every day, I just think it's very difficult to add. I mean, you have communities, you have jobs, you have students, you have alma maters on the line. And so I think just asking the university system to do this without some sense of legislators saying, we think it's like base closing at the federal level, what they've just went through. I think you've got to set up a process around it. And I don't know if this gets you there, but it's so tough because you're dealing with people's alma maters and their jobs and their whole livelihoods that without the legislature, if we just say, go do it, I just don't know if you're going to get, and I wouldn't blame them all that much, because I just don't know that you have that critical mass to push that conversation. And I'm willing to. We get to make the decisions, obviously, everything they bring back to us. But I just feel like we have to involve ourselves if we really want to push this, as far as I'd like to at least push them to think.
Well, Madam Chair, yes, on behalf of the Chancellor and the State Board, we've discussed this, and we firmly believe, I would have to agree with Senator Deckard, there is a great deal of external pressure within the higher education community on what happens to a particular institution, what happens to an institution, what happens at an institution. The State Board of Higher Education, with the legislature's endorsement of this type of study, it would give them some relief from that external and internal pressure. So we would welcome that piece of it. So that is why we would be supportive and welcome this bill.
Okay. No further questions? Or questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to comment? Did you have? You're just hanging out? Not the purview of this bill, however. Okay. And the -3 amendment, Mr. Well, let's close the public hearing, move to work session on Senate Bill 747. And the -3 amendments make the specific modifications, just rearranging language and including. Okay, would you like to do that?
I will try. Getting, of course, bring my copy back up. Madam Chair, Lisa Zavala again. Excuse me. The -3 amendments will, as I said, they do reword the scope of the study that will be undertaken by the State Board. And we've asked for those, the change in language, so that it better comports with the intent of the State Board as it proceeds in its long-range planning, which is just now actually beginning the work to commence that study. It's at right now just the staff level work, and so this was just kind of our way of getting something lined up with what the board would like to do, so it just is more compliant with that than the bill as you have it in the engrossed version.
Okay.
I have one question, Madam Chair.
Representative Lim.
And when you are considering all of those things mentioned in here, missions and budget, and in here the F is the structure. When you talk about the structure, do you have an intention to study a possible merging issue, the PSU, OHSU, plus other things? Is that included in here, or that's out of picture?
Madam Chair, Representative Lim, that we don't have it at that level of detail in terms of what the state board is going to be studying. Those types of issues or those types of recommendations or proposals may or may not come out of the work of the state board as they're studying this. It's too early to tell, Representative.
Additional questions? Ms. Zavala, on the amendments on the lines 17, 18, 19, the report shall include but not be limited to findings about recommendations and implementation plans for ensuring the long-term financial and academic sustainability for each institution. Yes. Now, you're talking about the viability and maintainability of each institution. And as I was getting the vision that both of you were giving, that vision could possibly mean a merging or morphing of an institution or two here and there. And are we maintaining them individually, or are we planning for a revamping of how our system is set?
Madam Chair, I think all of the above. The language that we're talking about, the viability of, I think that also means not only the financial and fiscal viability of maintaining each institution, but also the academic, the social, the other economic benefits of having the institution. Again, it is very early in this process, and so a lot of the finer details of the scope of the study are yet to be really determined, but this gives us a general but broad enough outline for the state board to follow as it's commencing its work.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, we'll move to. Do we have to continue with that? Chair.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 747A. Let's go up and do some amendments first. Madam Chair, I move the dash 3 amendments to set Senate Bill 747A.
Representative Dahlem has moved the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 747A. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So move. Next.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 747A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
And rescind?
And rescind the... Where are we?
Rescind
the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Mm-hmm.
And then, and then refer it to the Committee on Budget. Out of Ways and Means and into the budget.
That's the effort here. Representative Dahlem has moved Senate Bill 747A to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation to rescind the prior reference referral to the Committee on Ways and Means and to refer this to the Committee on Budget. I think that gets us there. Is there any discussion?
I don't think that's true.
Okay, then. Those of the opinion that Senate Bill 747A should be reported to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation to rescind the referral to the Ways and Means by prior reference and to refer to the Committee on Budget will vote aye. Those opposed will vote no. Clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Barr?
Aye.
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 Aye. The motion having received the required majority is declared passed. And who's our higher ed guru here? I guess we don't have to do a referral because it's going to budget.
No.
Decision of the bill.
We're going to get out of here just in time.
We are. Thank you very much. Seeing no further business come before the committee, we will stand adjourned. Until you hear further.